Welcome, welcome. I'm Bill Tinker, and you're listening to Dialysis Talk on Blog Talk Radio, where we discuss the healthcare issues of dialysis patients along with other present-day healthcare issues. Dialysis Talk is brought to you by Dialysis Advocates. The information and opinions expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the opinion of Dialysis Talk or Dialysis Advocates. We have a great show lined up for you tonight, and with that, let's turn it over to tonight's host. Well, this is Bill Tinker again. I'm going to be the host tonight, but I have a co-host. Her name is Kathy Day. Kathy is a registered nurse for the past 45 years. She's retired right now, but tonight we're going to be talking about the problems with needle pricks and some of the infections that can happen in operating rooms and through some of the mistakes that are made in hospitals and clinics. And Kathy is going to help me with that tonight. Kathy, can you give us a short little step about how you got involved with what you're doing now with patients and advocates and the safety within the nursing field?
Absolutely. I was retired and had been for quite a few years when my father became ill in 2008. He had a minor injury and was rehabilitated in this hospital where he contracted MRSA pneumonia and later died. And we didn't know that there was an outbreak in the hospital. There was no transparency at that time, and so we didn't have the information we needed to keep him safe and protected. The more I learned about MRSA, the more I realized how much we had to improve patient safety and work really hard to try to reduce or eliminate healthcare-associated infections in healthcare settings. So I got involved with several groups on both the local state, and the national level, and I've just continued this work since then, and pretty much broadened too into general patient safety, not just healthcare-associated infections.
Okay, well, that sounds like you've got unfortunately had a bad case of losing a parent through that, and obviously it shined a light for you on that. So thanks, Sue, for coming to the show and being my co-host tonight. Without further ado, we're going to talk about our main guest tonight, and that's Dr. Mark Davis. Mark is the author of a new book called Irresponsible: What Surgeons Won't Tell You and How to Protect Yourself. It's a must-read for members of every family. It's available at Amazon.com and as a Kindle book, which I'm reading right now myself. But you can also read it on your computer, tablet, or smartphone using the free Kindle app. Now, Dr. Davis is an author of over 40 medical articles and several books. We'll discuss how patients can empower themselves and take charge of their own treatment by learning how best to identify a safe surgeon in a safe facility. Dr. Davis is a surgeon with 40 years of experience. He's worked on operating room safety consultants for the past 20 years. He has worked with the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, known as the CDC, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, and he's helped develop the patient and healthcare worker safety guidelines. He specializes in preventing a growing problem, the spread of HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and resulting from contaminated medical equipment, from needle pricks and other sharp objects, including injuries during surgical procedures. Now, I know this show is basically a lot to do with dialysis patients, but we have to realize that in the dialysis industry and dialysis care, we are dealing with needles and we are dealing with blood and bloodborne pathogens, a possibility of those. So this is the reason why we're into this tonight with Dr. Davis. Dr. Davis, welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Kathy. Thanks very much for inviting me to share my thoughts on patient safety from the perspective of a surgeon. I am a surgeon, an OBGYN, to be exact, but I've also been a surgical patient. Mm-hmm. So I've been on both ends of the scalpel, and I've given safety a lot of thought. And I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you tonight, and it's an honor to share this platform with you.
One
bit of
you.
News I'd like... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go on with your...
One bit of news I'd like to share, I'm excited to announce that we just launched a new website. So if people want to contact me or learn more, they can go to irresponsiblethebook.com.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that both Kathy and I have got some questions for you, so I'll get on with the show here. Doctor, why do people need to know about the risk of acquiring a serious infection during a surgical procedure, and is there anything patients can do to really help prevent it?
Yes, sir. People do need to know about the risk of acquiring a serious infection during surgery, and not just people who currently are patients. Every citizen needs to know about this because sooner or later, everyone will have to face surgery, either their own or that of a family member. According to a recent study by the American College of Surgeons, the average American will have 9.2 surgical procedures in a lifetime. That figure kind of surprised me, but we are living longer and we're having a lot of procedures. So it's not a question of if, but when. The second part of the question, what can patients do to help prevent acquiring a serious infection from surgery? And the answer is they absolutely can. The surgical team, led by the surgeon, of course, has a responsibility to follow safe protocols and use the safest equipment available to keep the risk of a serious infection as close to zero as possible. Is that what always happens? Definitely not. It also goes without saying that reusable equipment should be properly cleaned and disinfected. Is that what always happens? Unfortunately, no. Caregivers should wash their hands before touching patients. Is that what always happens? Unfortunately, no. As a matter of fact, it has proved impossible to get doctors to wash their hands, so the infection control community has just given up trying. And some years ago, they said, all right, use a hand sanitizer. So now when you enter a hospital, you see these dispensers all over the walls. And that's great because these products work better than washing with soap and water. But still, they're not always used. So what can the patient do? The answer boils down to two words, ask questions. And before the hour's over, I'm going to tell listeners what questions to ask. And believe me when I say this works. Asking the right questions could save your life. Patients have to become involved in their own care and the decision-making process. Decisions like, do I really need surgery? Or do I really need to have certain tests to determine whether surgery is indicated? Or is a particular surgeon committed to following best safe practices? And how can I find out? What do I need to ask the surgeon or physician? If I do consent to surgery, how can I protect myself from medical errors once I get to the hospital or surgery center? Bill, these are the types of questions that patients and their support persons need to ask and the decisions they need to become involved in so they can stand up for their own safety. And I'll get into this in more detail a little bit later.
Thank you, Dr. Davis. Those are incredible bits of advice. Our second question is, can you tell our audience how you became interested in advancing patient safety?
Yes, Kathy, and I love telling this story. It takes a few minutes, so here we go. It all began with a scary event that changed the course of my life. The year was 1987, during the decade that everyone first learned about the existence of HIV and AIDS. I was cut with a scalpel while operating on a patient. She was a woman whose baby I had delivered a year previously, so I knew her quite well. She was what we used to call an apparently low-risk patient for having HIV. In other words, she was married, healthy, and not a drug abuser, so I wasn't too worried. But because of the severity of my cut and the fact that I knew for sure that our blood had intermixed as a result, I decided to test her anyway. This was the first time I had ever tested a patient for HIV. As she was coming out of anesthesia in the recovery room, I went to see her and explained what happened. I'd been cut with a scalpel, and I'd like her permission to test her for HIV. Her answer made my head spin. Oh, yes, Dr. Davis. I've been meaning to ask you for the past year if I should get tested, but I was too embarrassed to bring it up in the office. I found out my husband's gay, and I think he and his boyfriend are injecting drugs. To make a long story short, it ended well. She tested negative, but until I got the result back, my life was flashing in front of me. I had learned a powerful lesson. Also, around that time, the CDC found that every day across this country, there are an average of 1,000 needle sticks, scalpel cuts, and other sharp device injuries inflicted on healthcare workers in operating rooms. This number shocked me when I first read it, and I imagine it shocks our listeners. But instinctively, I knew it had to be true, because like most surgeons I've ever spoken to, and I've spoken to a lot, I had been a victim of many needle sticks over my career, mostly self-inflicted, but sometimes other surgeons or my assistants had stuck me, or I had stuck some of my assistants. So after my scary injury and potential exposure, the question in my mind became, how could I protect myself and my surgical team members from sharp device injuries with every surgical procedure? Now, everyone is pretty careful, but 1,000 injuries a day makes it clear that just being careful when using sharps does not get the job done. And the reason why is that the operating room is a dynamic and dangerous place. Surgeons and assistants are crowded together around the table, elbow to elbow. Speed is essential. And as a result, collisions and misdirected sharp instruments are a fact of life. I did find some good fixes for the problem, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. Now, it's one thing to speak about safety for surgeons and assistants in the OR, but here's where patient safety becomes involved. Starting in the 1980s and 90s, reports started filtering in of patients who had gone in for a surgical procedure and later came to find out they'd been infected with HIV or hepatitis C or hepatitis B or both or all three, something that both patients and the medical community at that time were unaware could even happen. Now, I'm going to mention some documented cases to illustrate this point. And I don't mean to scare patients or the general public, but it's important to understand the risk so people can use this knowledge to empower and protect themselves. So between 1987 and 89, there was a Florida dentist who was infected with AIDS, and he transmitted HIV to five of his patients. These were the first cases of healthcare worker to patient transmission of HIV that the CDC was aware of. Over the years, other cases were reported, including a French orthopedic surgeon in 1999 who was infected with AIDS and transmitted HIV to a patient during a hip replacement. In 2003, an obstetrician in Spain infected with AIDS transmitted HIV to a patient during a C-section. Between 1991 and 2005, worldwide, 11 surgeons infected with hepatitis C transmitted their infections to 38 patients, including 14 patients in the U.S. Also during that time, worldwide, 12 surgeons infected with hepatitis B transmitted their infection to 91 patients, including 19 in the U.S. To update this trend, since 2005, over the past 10 years, there have been reports of hundreds to thousands of patients exposed to hepatitis C during colonoscopy, dialysis, and major surgical procedures due to improper cleaning and sterilization of equipment, as well as needle sticks to surgeons. These are some of the known documented cases. There may be others. Now, don't freak out. Sharp object injuries are daily events, but transmission of HIV or hepatitis is definitely not. No one knows exactly how often these infections are transmitted in this way, because there's not a good system for tracking and reporting new cases of these diseases. In addition, instances of infection transmission may escape public view when malpractice lawsuits against surgeons and hospitals are settled out of court with confidentiality agreements. In those cases, in exchange for monetary compensation, patients are prohibited from revealing how they became infected. To be clear on how this risk comes about, here's what listeners need to understand. The transmission of HIV and hepatitis viruses during surgery occurs as a result of injuries caused by needles, scalpels, and other sharp instruments used during procedures. These injuries cause exposure to blood, which may harbor these viral infections. But the risk is bidirectional. In other words, patients can infect surgeons. However, surgeons can also infect patients. Infections can also occur, as you know, when instruments or equipment is improperly cleaned after use on a different patient. Examples being colonoscopy, duodenoscopy, and dialysis equipment. Safety experts believe that the transmission of infection in this manner should be labeled as never events, meaning surgical mistakes that should never happen, because most sharp device injuries are preventable if, and only if, surgeons and other healthcare workers take appropriate precautions. Here's the problem. Many of them don't, and that's what we're going to talk about. This is probably the first time many listeners are hearing about the risk of HIV and hepatitis transmission during surgery, and I can almost guarantee that this risk does not appear on the surgical consent form that patients are required to sign before surgery. So, Bill and Kathy, to summarize what I just said, the short answer to how I got involved in the safety movement is, first, I became frightened, then I became informed, then I made safety a top priority in my own OR, and finally, I became passionate about spreading the message of safer surgery for the patient and the OR team.
Wilbert, as someone who's had several colonoscopies, that makes me pause to think about some of the possibilities there. So, well, doctor, what are the types of procedures, other than that, that can expose patients to these deadly infections? And what infections do patients need to be really concerned about?
Well, let me answer the second part of that question first. There are two groups of infections that patients may be exposed to when they go into the hospital or to have a procedure. First, there are the viral infections I mentioned, HIV and hepatitis. And these are bloodborne pathogens. In other words, when a care provider or a patient is exposed to the blood of an infected person, they can get the disease. The other group of infections, which have gotten much more media attention, are the bacterial infections, including the so-called hospital superbugs, which are resistant to almost all antibiotics. Examples include staph, MRSA, and VRE. These bacterial infections kill many thousands of patients every year, and I'm sure Kathy can speak to this with authority. To answer the first part of your question, which procedures expose patients to infection? The truth is it's almost every type of procedure from head to toe, from cardiac to abdominal surgery to dialysis or colonoscopy. Again, what I'm telling you is not intended to scare anyone. It's to inform people of these risks, to empower patients with that knowledge, and as I'll speak about later, give patients some tools to protect themselves before they go in.
That's a great answer to that question, Dr. Davis. Thank you. We hear a lot about dirty, reusable instruments spreading infections. Which types of facilities are involved in failing to protect patients?
Well, unfortunately, the answer is all facilities. Let me mention one particularly egregious violation as an example. Recently, it was revealed that 12,000 children and young adults treated at Seattle Children's Bellevue Clinic and Surgery Center since 2010 could be at risk of infection with hepatitis B, C, and HIV from instruments that might not have been properly sterilized. This information is actually on the hospital's website. Imagine 12,000 parents receiving a phone call or letter saying your child needs to come in and be tested. This is the second time in 2 years that Seattle Children's has alerted patients about problems with sterilizing surgical equipment. In January 2014, the hospital notified about 100 patients that colonoscopes might not have been properly cleaned. None of those patients came down with an infection, but the testing of the 12,000 is still ongoing. And your question is a very timely one because just last week, the CDC issued an official health advisory to all healthcare providers and facilities about the public health need to properly maintain, clean, and disinfect or sterilize reusable medical devices. And I'm going to read directly from the alert now. The warning says, quote, recent infection control lapses due to noncompliance with recommended reprocessing procedures highlight a critical gap in patient safety. Healthcare facilities, including hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, clinics, and doctor's offices that utilize reusable medical devices are urged to immediately review current reprocessing practices at their facility to ensure they, number one, are complying with all steps as directed by the device manufacturer, and two, they have in place appropriate policies and procedures that are consistent with current standards and guidelines. The warning continues with this recommendation. Quote, healthcare facilities should arrange for a healthcare professional with expertise in device reprocessing to immediately assess their reprocessing procedures. This assessment should ensure that reprocessing is done correctly, including allowing enough time for personnel to follow all steps recommended by the device manufacturer, end quote. Bill and Kathy, I suspect that many listeners out there may be thinking, this is 2015, and we're not an underdeveloped nation. Don't facilities already know the correct procedures to follow? This is not the first time facilities have been warned. So I'd like to suggest to all patients, their families, and the general public, they must get involved in order to fix this problem, because facilities clearly cannot be trusted to police themselves. So starting tomorrow and going forward, if anyone is planning to receive care at a hospital, surgery center, clinic, or doctor's office, I would suggest that they do the following. When it's time to give your patient information to register at the facility, and or when it's time to schedule the procedure, you, the patient, along with your support person, request that the facility provide you with a copy of the appropriate updated policies and procedures for cleaning instruments, as recommended by the CDC. I've had multiple procedures, and the next time I need another one, that's what I'm going to do. Let's all apply pressure and power that we have as healthcare consumers to provide a wake-up call to all facilities, or else these problems are going to continue.
Sorry, my mic was turned off. Wire-sharp device injuries that expose surgeons and patients to potentially infected blood so common. And from your viewpoint as a surgeon, what can be done about it?
Well, as I mentioned, these types of adverse events, needle sticks and so on, occur 1,000 times a day in this country. They also occur in other areas like patient rooms where IVs are started and injections are given, or in labs where they draw blood. But in those areas, unlike the OR, the numbers of injuries have decreased markedly, and the reason is technology along with compliance. Injection needles, IV catheters, and blood draw needles nowadays usually have safety shields, which make needle sticks much less likely. One reason that facilities have switched over to safety needles is because OSHA has mandated that facilities use these devices or else risk stiff fines. But as far as the OR, researchers have identified the causes for these astonishing number of sharp object injuries. And this matched what I observed every day in my surgical practice. So based on all of that, I developed a strategy that I used successfully for preventing injuries during the last 10 years of my practice. And this is something that I recommend all surgical teams follow. I wrote about this in my 2001 book for the OR professional, Advanced Precautions for Today's OR. And I can tell you that many OR nurses and scrub techs read that book, and they got it. But unfortunately, very few surgeons did. Let me tell you about the exposure prevention strategy that I developed for the OR. It utilizes a half dozen readily available and proven effective safety devices and safe surgical techniques, which I would like listeners to understand, because this will enable them to find out if their surgeon pays appropriate attention to safety. If this was video instead of radio, I could show you more easily how these things work, but just use your imagination a little bit, and I think you'll get it. First, let's talk about safety needles. Not for drawing blood or starting IVs or injections, but they're also what we call blunt-tip suture needles for closing incisions. And that is all layers of the incision except the skin. These needles don't penetrate skin, so they can't injure the healthcare worker, but they do penetrate the tissues below the skin. They're extremely effective, but only about 5% of surgeons use them. The next thing is safety scalpels. These have blades that either can be covered with a shield or blades that retract into the handle of the scalpel for safety. They're also quite effective. Surgeons know about them, but less than 5% use them. The third thing is passing Sharp's instruments safely to what I call a neutral zone. The way this works, the nurse does not hand the surgeon the scalpel or suture. Instead, she places it in a tray in front of the surgeon, and the surgeon then picks it up, uses it, and returns it to the tray, and the nurse retrieves it. This eliminates untold numbers of collisions and injuries. The fourth strategy that I and some other surgeons use is performing surgery without sharp instruments. Believe it or not, it works. We use scissors a lot instead of scalpels, and we use our fingers to bluntly dissect tissue. It's actually possible to perform some types of surgery entirely without a sharp instrument, or parts of most operations without a sharp instrument. The fifth strategy is wearing two pairs of gloves. When surgeons wear only one pair of gloves, what they find when they remove them at the end of the case is that they have blood on their hands 50% of the time, according to one study. When they wear two pairs of gloves, the incidence of exposure to blood drops to 4%. And the sixth strategy is communication, effective and respectful communication. This is modeled after the airline industry, where it was developed out of necessity to protect passengers from air disasters. Surgeons sometimes famously yell, curse, or even throw things at nurses and assistants. Did you ever hear a pilot yell at a flight attendant? I don't think so. Because the aviation industry figured out a long time ago that effective and respectful communication empowers everybody on the team, and it's absolutely necessary for safety. Multiple studies show the significant effectiveness of all these strategies in reducing sharps injuries and blood exposures. And when they're all used in combination, as I did, the rate of exposure to blood approaches zero. Unfortunately, largely due to surgeons' resistance to change, these strategies are only sporadically used nationwide, and that's what needs to change. In spite of the fact that the American College of Surgeons and six other surgical organizations recommend the use of safety scalpels and blunt suture needles, only 5% of surgeons use them. There's even a federal law passed in the year 2000, signed by Bill Clinton into law, the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act, that demands that safer devices be used. In addition, OSHA requires that hospitals provide these safety devices. But here's the catch. There's no law that requires that surgeons actually use them. So the bottom line is, surgeons decide which instruments to use. They still have a choice of the traditional dangerous ones or the new safe ones that have the safety devices, safety features built in by design. And I believe patients can and will be able to influence those choices by speaking up.
Thank you. I'm interested in what you just had to say. Sometimes I feel there's too much choice. That's my opinion, but we'll go on with the next question. But thank you for the response to the last one. In your book, you have a section you call the Surgical Patient Safety Toolkit. One of the things you talk about is why patients need to have a support person and a patient advocate. This is something I work on all the time, patient engagement. Why is this so important?
Yes. I can't overstate the importance of having a support person. The other term for that is patient advocate. It can possibly affect the outcome. And, of course, that could be your spouse or another family member or a friend. And ideally, he or she should accompany you on every office visit to a surgeon or physician. This is especially important if you're being evaluated for possible diagnostic tests and or surgery. Even though the surgeon may be a good communicator, and let's be honest, some are not, all patients are understandably nervous in a medical office. I've been there, and you've been there. You may not be able to focus on important things the surgeon tells you, including your diagnosis, tests you may need, the potential risks of surgery, and alternative non-surgical treatment options. I've been there as a patient many times, and I always bring a list of questions that are printed out with room after each question to write down the answers I get from the doctor. Your support person can help prevent mistakes from happening by reminding you to ask important questions that will help you make the right decisions regarding testing and surgery. If you decide to have surgery, make sure your support person accompanies you to the hospital or surgery center. Mistakes occur every day, and while most are minor and cause no harm, others can be lethal. When nurses or other personnel approach you with medications or IVs, your support person can help prevent mistakes by verifying your identity, your diagnosis, and the procedure you're going to have done. Hand hygiene is critical in preventing hospital-acquired infection with antibiotic-resistant bugs. So if a nurse or doctor enters your room and approaches you without first using the hand sanitizer, you or your safety advocate should remind them to do so. Several years ago, a family member of mine had surgery and complications. I slept in a chair beside her bed for almost a month, and I believe I was able to prevent a multitude of medical and surgical mistakes from happening. And I talk about that experience in my book.
Well, in your book, you provided some patient safety checklists. The first one is what to ask a surgeon the first time you meet. What should we as patients ask our surgeon?
Well, just as surgical teams should use safety checklists, but often don't, and by the way, they don't always use them correctly, I believe patients should use safety checklists of their own to help ensure that errors don't occur. Transparency, which equals knowing that there are risks, knowing what they are, and being an educated and empowered healthcare consumer, are the most powerful tools available to patients. The first checklist is called What You Must Ask the Surgeon the First Time You Meet. And this is a reflection of the focus on my book on the risk of bloodborne pathogen exposure. This checklist contains the half dozen important safety devices and safe techniques that I mentioned that surgeons should use to prevent Sharpe's injuries and exposure to blood. Most surgeons don't use them. Some use some of them. Let's imagine you've been referred to a surgeon. Here's the way you should bring it up. Dr. Jones, I've been reading about patients, surgeons, and OR nurses who became infected with hepatitis C and HIV during surgery. I understand there are safety precautions that surgeons use to lower this risk. Would you mind if I ask you a few questions? Now, the answers you get will give you a good idea of the level of concern that the surgeon has for your safety. The most safety-minded surgeons will likely answer yes to most, if not all, of those six questions. When the surgeon, whether the surgeon says he uses them or not, after he or she has responded, you should tell him or her that you would like these precautions used during your surgery. This is a perfectly reasonable request, one that OSHA basically requires, and one that reasonable surgeons would not have a problem complying with. If, on the other hand, the surgeon says something like, these things are not important, or I don't find a need for them, or I'm very careful and I've never had a problem, remember, you have the option of getting a second opinion. I think that's when you should. Bill?
Thank you for that response. What about the checklist called What to Ask Your Surgeon to Protect Yourself When You Are Having Tests to Determine If You Need Surgery?
Yes, this one I think is equally important to the first one. This is a way that patients can really take control of their health care. When they're recommending that you have some preoperative tests that may determine whether you need surgery, here's some of the things that I think patients absolutely need to ask. And you bring this list with you. What symptoms that I have make you think I might need surgery? How confident are you about the diagnosis? What further tests might be helpful to improve your confidence? Will the tests you're proposing change the treatment plan? In other words, are they really necessary? What risks do the tests have? Are there findings or symptoms that do not fit your diagnosis? And what else could it be? can you help me get a second opinion by giving me my medical records? When should I expect to see my test results? Will you discuss the results face-to-face with me in your office? What resources can you give me or recommend for me to learn more about my diagnosis? Simply by asking these questions, it may become apparent that you don't need the test or the surgery, or maybe you need to get another opinion.
Dr. Davis, if I'm going to the hospital or I've talked to the doctor, you know, but what are the things that I really need to tell the doctor about myself, you know, in relation to what we're talking about?
Well, the doctor or the surgeon is supposed to ask you these questions, but I think you should take a proactive approach. So here's a checklist you should bring with you to ensure that the surgeon or doctor has your important medical information. Your medical history, all medical conditions, heart disease, high blood pressure, lung problems, kidney problems, etc. Your surgical history, previous surgeries and complications, if any. Your allergies to medications or foods. Your medications. Bring a complete list of all your medications, including over-the-counter products, vitamins and supplements, and the times that you take them and the dosages. If you bring a list like this with you and hand it to the nurse or doctor, I guarantee you that the surgeon or physician will be impressed. This tells him that here is a patient who is informed, educated, and empowered to play a role in their own safe health care.
So what information should the patient give the pre-op nurse and the anesthesia doctor or nurse?
Well, this is extremely important. First of all, you need to ask those people some questions. And here's what's on that checklist. You ask the pre-op nurse and anesthesia person the following. What name do you have on my chart? What date of birth do you have on my chart? What procedure am I having? And then you tell them the medications that you take, hand them a list. Tell them your allergies, any diagnoses, medical and surgical. The diagnosis, the reason you're having surgery, the location of the planned surgical procedure on your body, and this is so, so important, and always specify the left or right side, the left or right side, the left arm, the left leg, the right hip, the right knee, the left eye, the right side of the brain, the left breast, the right kidney, or other organ. This can avoid the dreaded complication of having the wrong procedure or even on the wrong patient. Now, at that point, the surgeon's supposed to come in and mark the surgical site with the patient still awake. And this is absolutely critical to prevent having something go wrong.
Well, you know, the patient's trying to get their medical records. Should we have copies of all of our medical records?
Absolutely. Every time you visit a doctor or a lab, you should request a copy of the records, the doctor's office notes, and the lab results. Labs don't send those to you directly. They send it to your doctor, so you can ask your doctor for a copy. Why should you bother about this? Because having this information can help you fully understand your diagnosis and treatment. It enables you to ask questions and learn more. You can go to the internet and learn what questions you need to ask the doctor. You should make copies of all your records to give to your other doctors when you see them. This allows all of your doctors to coordinate and improve your total care. It's really important that all your doctors have the same information. And when you receive your records and lab results, verify that you're yours, that they are yours, and not somebody else's. Make sure your name and the date the tests were done appear at the top of the page. And this could avoid receiving an incorrect diagnosis that could lead to improper treatment or unnecessary and dangerous for further tests.
So in general, what advice can you give patients on how to find a surgeon who gets good results and how can they find a safe hospital or other facility?
Yes, Kathy. In addition to these checklists that we've gone through that are in the book, I describe other ways that patients can find information about the quality of surgeons and other doctors. One good website is called HealthGrades, and that's one word, healthgrades.com. This tells you the doctor's area of specialization, years of experience, hospital affiliations, whether they're board certified in their specialty, whether they're malpractice claims or sanctions by the State Board of Medical Examiners, and whether patients recommend them. If you're shopping around for a doctor, this is really, really useful. To find out more about the diagnosis that you've been given, there's some really excellent websites, including WebMD, Mayo Clinic, and Cleveland Clinic. You just put in a diagnosis in the search bar, and you can find out an awful lot about that diagnosis. And you can also make a list of questions based on that for your next doctor visit. Now, how can you recognize a good surgeon or physician when you see one? Well, here's a couple of things to look for. And you, together with your support person, can tell a great deal the first time you meet simply by how they interact with you. First, a good surgeon communicates effectively. This starts with listening carefully to what you have to say. They should be looking you in the eye when you're speaking. This is so important because your symptoms often reveal the diagnosis. A good surgeon explains the benefits and risks of surgery, as well as alternative forms of treatment that might avoid the need for surgery. A good surgeon tells you what the rate of success of your proposed surgery is in his hands and what the national statistics are. They should tell you how many times he or she has performed the operation that they're recommending and what his or her complication rate is for that surgery. And if they don't volunteer this information, it's your job to ask for it. Goes without saying that a good surgeon or physician returns your phone calls promptly. That could be a little hard to come up with in this day and age. Everyone's so busy and they don't hire enough people for the office. A good surgeon honestly and completely tells you what to expect after surgery, because your recovery depends on knowing how much pain or discomfort you'll have and what your restrictions will be. A good surgeon doesn't send you home before it's safe, and a good surgeon will check you post-op in the office as often as necessary, even if your insurance does not reimburse for those kinds of visits. Now, what about finding a safe hospital or facility? Unfortunately, surgeons, hospitals, and surgery centers are under extreme pressure from the health insurance industry to cut costs. So too often, this means cutting corners and compromising safety. Examples include hiring insufficient number of nurses or having them work 12-hour shifts, which are just dangerous. Also, cramming as many surgical procedures as possible into the daily OR schedule, sending patients home too early after surgery, and failing to provide sufficient post-op follow-up. When this happens, complications often are not recognized early or treated early enough, with disastrous results. As patients, we need unbiased, objective information when selecting a physician or facility for ourselves or the family. As I already mentioned, one place to look for answers is HealthGrades, which gives information on the quality of care provided by hospitals, as well as surgeons, physicians, and dentists. And they do this by measuring clinical outcomes, including mortality rates and in-hospital complications. Their data analysis is based on approximately 40 million Medicare patients discharged from the hospital for the most recent three-year time period available. For any given hospital, you can find out whether their performance was worse than average, average, or better than average. Well, you might want to really have more information than that, but at least it's a start. And they do this for 14 different patient safety indicators. Unfortunately, one patient safety indicator that HealthGrades does not measure is the incidence of Sharps injuries and transmission of HIV and hepatitis virus in a given hospital. Now, one last bit. How can you tell if a facility has a culture of safety? And we read a lot about a culture of safety, how important that is. And a culture of safety, by the way, does not exist unless the top-level people at that facility believe in it, and they make the others toe the line. And while it's nice if a hospital validates your parking ticket, that's not an indicator of quality care. Some positive signs would include nurses who identify themselves and call you by name during every patient encounter. Another is a sign on the wall of your room that says, if the doctor or nurse does not use a hand sanitizer before touching you, please remind them. For patients needing colonoscopy, dialysis, upper GI endoscopy, or other invasive procedures, they should ask the doctor and facility manager if their procedures for cleaning and decontamination of equipment are up to the highest standard, and ask to see that documentation. If every patient did this, I believe it would shine the light of transparency on doctors and facilities. If they know that they're under the spotlight, they'll be more likely to responsibly monitor and comply with safety procedures. And that's a good summary, I hope.
Well, Dr. Davis, that's certainly informative, especially with something that things we're talking about as far as dialysis patients, because we do get reports a lot through dialysis advocates here of problems within the dialysis industry as far as the cleanliness and some of the lack of use of gloves and some of the other things there. And obviously they're using a lot of needles, a lot of, putting needles in the fistulas, and there's a lot of bloodborne things that happen with blood there. So before we get done here, I'd like to go back to one question you have here, and that was the patients needing the medical records. You know, within the dialysis, for some reason, it's very, very hard for our dialysis patients to get their medical records. I don't know if it's because the clinics say that they're private, but I always thought that you were entitled to all of your medical records.
Well, that's right, Bill. The medical records are your property. If you're the patient, that's your property, and you're certainly entitled to them. So,
right.
American
taxpayer is paying for that, and we seem to run into a wall sometimes when people ask for their medical records, or they'll use a slight thing of some of our poorer patients and saying, well, yeah, you can have a 25 cents a copy for copying and sending to you. So that's unfortunate that we have patients that can't get their records when they'd like to get them. For those of you who listen to the show here tonight, Dr. Davis's book is Irresponsible, What Surgeons Won't Tell You and How to Protect Yourselves. And it's available on Amazon.com, and you can get it as a Kindle book. You can also read it on your computer, tablet. I'm reading it on my Kindle at this point. And it's a wonderful book. I think it has some really good ideas, some things that the nurses, people that are in the business, medical professionals, and a lot of us who are patients need to really pay attention to what is going on with your care at a hospital or surgery or even in a dialysis clinic. We're responsible for our own safety in many ways. Yes, the clinic, the doctor, and all, they're responsible for their end of it. But you and I as patients, we're responsible for taking care of ourselves, being proactive, and asking the questions that need to be asked to protect you and your family. At this point, Dr. or Kathy, have you got anything that you'd like to add to this?
No, I'm just really very impressed with the information that you've shared today. It's very similar to some of the same kinds of things that we discuss in the Consumers Union Safe Patient Project. I don't know if you're familiar with that. They're under the Consumer Reports umbrella, and there is a sector of Consumer Reports that's called Consumer Health, and much of the advice that you've given is right in sync with the advice that they're giving to patients and consumers. So I was really excited to hear a lot of your suggestions for patients, and I agree with Bill that we, as patients, we're responsible for our end of things by being engaged and empowered with information, and the advocacy part of it is essential. I don't think it's optional. I think it's absolutely essential, and we can influence our outcomes by being the so-called e-patient, and it's very, very important. So that's basically all I had to add.
That's very well said, Kathy, and I'm amazed at how many organizations and bloggers there are out there. They're probably over 1,000, all trying to help patients become informed and empowered. And so there's a lot of information out there on the Internet and a lot of good people working in this field, as both of you are. And you know, when I go to the doctor or you go to the doctor or anyone does, the tendency is to be intimidated in the presence of a surgeon or physician. But don't let that happen. Ask the questions and take the time and do the preparation. Everybody's got a computer. Go on the Internet and find out what it's all about, and go in there armed with knowledge and the confidence that you can stand up for your own safety.
Are you familiar with the campaign called Choosing Wisely?
I believe I've seen it.
Yeah, it's a collaboration between the American Board of Internal Medicine and Consumer Reports. They do the consumer patient side of it, and the American Board of Internal Medicine does the physician side of it. And it's all about clinician-patient partnering and and not overusing diagnostic studies, but getting just right care. It's a really interesting campaign, and I was on a collaborative here in Maine working on that. And there are five questions that I'm just going to do this really quickly, but there are five questions that every patient should ask when they see their doctor. And the first thing is, you know, do I really need this, whatever, procedure, or diagnostic study, or whatever it happens to be? Do I really need it?
Right.
And if I do, are there alternatives? I mean, is there something else that could be done?
Mm-hmm.
And then number three is the risk. Is there risk involved with this procedure?
Right.
The fourth question is, I'm going to draw a blank. No, I'm not going to draw a blank. what if I don't do anything? Which I think is a really, really essential question. It's a really important question.
Yeah.
And then the final question is, how much does it cost? Because some people may get a recommendation that they in turn can't pay for. So they, you know, they may be endangered just because of the cost involved. So those are the five questions that this campaign encourages all patients to ask doctors when they go and see somebody and a recommendation is made. So.
Yeah, there's no way to rank those five questions in importance because they're all so important.
Yeah, quite essential, yeah.
One question.
Sure, go ahead.
I was going to say one question that I often get asked is that in the event of a blood exposure to the surgeon, let's say the surgeon gets stuck with an instrument in which there was also potential exposure of the patient to the surgeon's blood, it seems, you know, is it appropriate that the surgeon also be tested for HIV and hepatitis C as they would do for the patient? Well, I think it is, and I think the results ought to be given to the patient. The other question I get asked a lot is, what about surgeons who have hepatitis C, hepatitis B, or HIV? Are they allowed to continue to practice? And if so, under what restrictions? Well, it's handled differently at each facility in the U.S. There's a safety committee at every hospital, which decides whether the surgeon can continue to practice surgery and whether they can perform certain high-risk procedures or portions of certain procedures. Whereas in the UK, it's different if a surgeon has hepatitis, he or she must switch to a non-invasive specialty, such as family practice. And that may be because in the UK it's a single-payer system and they have a way to enforce a universal policy, but in this country, it's every facility for itself. So there are surgeons who are out there practicing who have hepatitis C. Now, typically what happens is if it's a group practice, that surgeon's partners will insist that the surgeon reveal this information to his patients. And typically what happens is they don't have any more patients at that point.
Interesting.
Well, you know, I'm thinking back
so
all the time. I've been to a doctor's office or a clinic or surgery. I've gone through surgery myself. I remember filling out voluminous forms about my medical history and what up, do I have this, do I have that, or have I ever had anything, you know, wrong with me or any diseases or infections or fevers. I don't believe I have ever had anything coming from the other direction saying this hospital has this or the doctor has that. So your point is very well taken. I don't think we as patients ever get anything from the hospital that says anything about the people working there.
No,
or
it's a one-way street.
It's
a one-way street, and there's no requirement that physicians be tested for bloodborne pathogens. And if they did, if they were tested and you asked for the results, they would probably say it's personal. It's my information. I can't share that with you.
Well, they do something with HIPAA for sure, But unfortunately, we are the patients. We're the people that are paying for the services, and obviously we don't want to contact anything.
Well, as patients, we have, we can vote with our feet. If we don't like what we hear or what we see, we can say we're going down the street and get another opinion. And I think if that happened more often, all the facilities and physicians would kind of get the idea that this is the age of patient empowerment. And, yes, I'm aware of these safe policies and procedures. Maybe it's time that I started following them consistently and actually use that as a way to market my practice and be proactive and say I do the following.
Exactly.
I
wanted to ask before we finish. I know we just have a few more minutes. Is that right? Is this,
yes.
What time is? Okay.
Yeah.
I just wondered if this is quick. I wondered if you're familiar with Honor Reform, Dr. Evelyn McKnight's organization. She was involved in a hepatitis C outbreak in 2001, the largest one ever recorded, apparently, in a cancer clinic. She works on this issue of, single needle, single use, because her hepatitis, she got hepatitis C, contracted it as a cancer patient because they were reusing needles to drop saline during chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
So they do some tremendous work, and I didn't know if you might be interested in reaching out to them. Honor Reform is the name of the organization. She's a doctor as well.
Right. I've seen her name on the Internet, and within the past few days I've been reviewing a lot of these sites. And I welcome the opportunity to work with anybody that wants to reach out to me also.
Okay.
If there's any way I can join forces or provide information, I'm happy to do it.
Excellent.
Well, I'd like to thank everybody. Our show is winding down here. Dr. Davis, Kathy, thanks for coming on the show. Those of you listening, the show will be archived and it'll be, you can listen to it tomorrow or any of our other programs on our show. They're all archived. And again, thank you very much for being a guest on board.
Thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for inviting us. Good night.
Okay. Thank you.